Thanks very much. Whenever whenever I was invited to come along to do this presentation, which I was very happy to do, I was head of the School of Education in Queen's, and as just been said, I'm now Pro-Vice Chancellor, and I only mention this at the start to emphasise that anything I say today is all down to me and doesn't represent, doesn't claim to represent the views of the school or of the university. Whenever I think about inclusive education or inclusive schools, this image in some ways embodies that idea for me, this notion of the US public school, and particularly the way that it's embodied in the idealised notion of the Little Red Schoolhouse. Because part of the notion, part of the whole ideal of the Little Red Schoolhouse was as a place that took people from hugely different circumstances and places, brought them together and turned them into US citizens. It was the sort of the engine, if you like, of the melting pot that helped to form the United States. But in Northern Ireland, we do things differently. We divide kids on the basis of age, which I suppose isn't that big a surprise because many places do it. We also divide them on the basis of gender, with lots of single-sex opportunities for young people. We divide them on the basis of ability, and given the way the system works, that's often also on the grounds of social background. We then divide them by religion. We throw in Irish medium schools, and then we throw in special schools. So the idea of the Little Red Schoolhouse breaks down quite considerably in a system such as ours, which creates such structural divisions. And in some senses, that is a sort of starting point for the comments that I want to make, that we have, I think, one of the most structurally divided education systems in this part of the world. And I think there are important consequences of that, consequences that cover a whole range of different areas. And I just want to illustrate some of those consequences now. One of the consequences can be seen in the most recent NISRA data, looking at area-based social disadvantage in its various different dimensions. The dots in this scatter plot are all different areas of Northern Ireland, small areas, and each of the dots represents the position of the different areas in terms of educational disadvantage on the one hand and employment disadvantage on the other. And you can see there's a very close relationship between these two, a very profound and close correlation. In areas that have high levels of educational disadvantage, also are areas that have very high levels of unemployment disadvantage. And the NISRA data also shows that this correlation, this sort of multiplier effect of disadvantage, doesn't affect just employment. It also, you get a very strong correlation when we look at the relationship between educational disadvantage and income levels. And you also get a very strong correlation between educational disadvantage and health outcomes, health disadvantage. All of these things are interconnected. And part of what I want to sort of suggest, part of what I want to argue, is that the way we organise things here in Northern Ireland reinforces those disadvantages so that some people, the people, if you like, at the bottom of the pile in our society, have all these multiplier effects of different aspects of disadvantage piled in on top of them. And in some senses, if we want to talk about an inclusive education system, or we want to develop a rhetoric where inclusion is meant to be part of what the education system is all about, then we have to engage with the actual realities on the ground, because the actual realities, as well as the structural divisions that I've already alluded to, here we can see very, very sort of clear patterns of social disadvantage being reinforced in the system. We can also see these levels of inequity when we look at other aspects of the system. Looking at the PISA data from 2006, which gives us sort of international comparisons of where Northern Ireland sits in performance terms in comparison to other OECD countries. You can see that if we rank Northern Ireland in terms of the average score, the mean score, on the different measures used in PISA, then we sit round about the middle of the distribution. These data are based on 50 different countries or 50 different jurisdictions. So on the rank of the mean scores of the performance measures, Northern Ireland is sitting round about the middle. But if you look at the rank of the distribution, you can see that Northern Ireland is sitting very much towards the bottom of the distribution. And that reflects the fact that even though on average terms, in a sort of a statistical terms, we're sitting round about the average, the level of inequity, the distribution of the variance in the system, is one of the widest in the OECD countries. So we have a profoundly unequal pattern of outcomes in relation to what goes on in our education system. And sometimes, because of the particular indicators we tend to privilege in the system, we delude ourselves that the system is working fine because the average is okay. There's a question mark whether a rhetoric around an average being okay is actually good enough. But even that hides the problems about inequalities, which is, in a sense, highlighted here when you look at the distributions. And if we look at individual schools, these are data for individual post-primary schools in Northern Ireland with the scale along the bottom. Get you a measure of social disadvantage provided by the proportion of pupils in the individual schools entitled to free school meals. And the vertical measure is a performance measure, the proportion of effectively 16-year-olds, year 12 pupils that are getting five or more good GCSEs, with each of the dots on the scatter plot representing an individual school. And a little clump of light blue dots at the top left-hand corner representing the grammar schools. And the blue diamonds right across the rest of the system representing the secondary schools. Quite apart from all the sort of comparisons between the different types of schools, whatever, the two things that always shocked me about this particular scattergram, we're looking at these data, is first of all the huge variation in terms of social circumstances of the schools, the challenges that they're facing, and the sort of consequences this has. If we're trying to develop an inclusive system, given that we heard examples earlier or before coffee about schools, principals, teachers struggling to promote inclusive practice within schools. If the system is setting this sort of a context up for them, what is the system doing to support the work that they're doing within individual schools? Well, you've got such sort of wide levels of experience in the schools in terms of social disadvantage. But allied to that is the huge variation in terms of performance outcomes, which reflects the point I was making earlier from the PISA data, that this level of inequity in terms of the experience of the young people and what they get out of schools is something that we're not attending to enough. Often, as I say, hidden because of the sort of indicators we use to try and make judgments about what's happening within the schools. It's not as if there haven't been things done to try and deal with this. Over the last 30 years or so, there has been a plethora of initiatives and policies put into place to try and address these issues. But one of the things which I find quite striking about a lot of these policies is that we often develop new ones before we've finished evaluating the old ones. So the extent to which any lessons are learned from one policy initiative that helps to influence and shape future development seems to me to be relatively low. And all of these new initiatives are developed and created and implemented and then eventually ended and new ones come along. But the problem that we're trying to address is sustained and keeps going on. Nothing fundamental ever seems to change in the system, despite the fact there's a sort of an endless blizzard of policy initiatives put in place to try and deal with them. So if that's the situation, if the system itself is so excluding unequal in terms of so many of the things that happen within that, what are some of the reasons for that? Well, let me suggest some sort of simple reasons. One reason I think that plays a role is that what we do when we're trying to address these issues is to use approaches that often focus on short-term goals, that are often focused on inputs, and often see problems as if they're disconnected or separable. And so solutions are developed that are trying to deal with particular things without seeing their interconnection with other things. What we need to do is a more strategic approach which recognises the persistent and long-term nature of the problems that we're dealing with and therefore tries to develop genuinely long-term strategies to try and deal with the problems. Focuses rigorously on outputs rather than inputs and so looks for things that are changed, that are going to change, not simply looking at the things that we do without any attention to whether it makes any difference. But also recognise the joined-up nature of the problems that we're addressing and therefore the need to develop joined-up solutions when we're trying to take these things forward. So here are three possible ways in which you might start to think about changing the way we think about some of these issues and take them forward. One based around the Pareto principle, which I'll talk about in a second. A second approach, taking some ideas from the whole literature on communities of learning and some ideas that come out of that. And the third around an idea which has been developed by a guy called Mark Granovetter when he talked about the strength of weak ties. And I want to say a little bit about each one of those and then indicate where this takes me in terms of the way I think we should be thinking sort of in a profound way about trying to develop an inclusive system and some of the implications of that. First of all, the Pareto principle. Anytime I'm feeling down, I look at photographs of the wonderful place that I work, Queen's University, and here's a few of the photographs to share with you. But I'm not showing you the photographs as sort of holiday snaps, but to illustrate a point. These photographs are all taken from the Flickr database. Some of you, I'm sure, use Flickr as a way of uploading your photographs onto the web and sharing them with family and friends. And lots of people use Flickr. It's a huge database. And if you go onto Flickr and you search it for photographs of Queen's University Belfast, then what you find is 1,622 photographs, all uploaded by 260 different photographers. That's an average of 6 photos per photographer, and I know because I did and I counted them all. That notion of 6 photographs per photographer is obviously mathematically correct. That's the average number of photographs that each one of the people who put photographs in Flickr of Queen's up on the site. But if you actually look at the distribution of the number of photographs that each of the photographers put up, it's the real pattern is very, very different. As you can see, it's a very skewed pattern. Huge numbers of people put up 1 or 2 photographs, and a very small number of people put up a very large number of photographs. And that's where the Pareto principle comes in, because in a lot of big databases, the Pareto principle essentially takes an 80-20 division. In this context, 20% of the photographers put up 80% of the photographs. Okay, that's the Pareto principle, this 80-20 division. Now, you may be wondering, what in heaven's name is he talking about, and what has this got to do with anything we're supposed to be talking about here today? Well, the reason I'm talking about this is because the Pareto principle, the 80-20 division, gives a very good illustration of the difference between old and new business models. Old business models focuses on the 20% of photographers, in this case, who produce the 80% of photographs, because the way in which that old business model operates is to professionalise or institutionalise that 20% and give up and forget about the 20% of the photographs that the 80% of the people are producing. In a world that's digital, that's moving very, very fast, where innovation has to be a priority, we can't afford to give up the 20%. We have to find ways of tapping into the 20%. In old world models, that maybe wasn't a big priority because, after all, what employer is going to employ someone who's going to hang around for three years and during that entire period come up with one good idea? But in the digital world, where innovation is the key, if that one big idea is the thing that changes everything, it's really, really important to try and connect to it. And that's why new business models have developed open source approaches to try and get beyond the boundaries of institutions to tap into the wider set of ideas that are necessary to try and develop models of innovation. And in a sense, I think, in education, we need to start trying to find ways of tapping into the other 20%, breaking out of the institutional boundaries that we've set for ourselves and that have served us for an awful long time, but I think now have gone beyond their sell-by date. So that's the first element, the Pareto principle. Second element around communities of learning. We know from the work on communities of learning that in order to develop learning within a community, it's necessary for that community to develop a strong identity. It's also necessary for it to develop a clear sense of boundaries, agreed goals within the people who are part of the community, and strong intergroup communication as they drive forward to try and achieve learning. We also know that although those are good starting conditions and initial conditions, if the community of learning stays like that, then there's a risk of stagnation, because eventually things that people are familiar with will all be familiar to those who are within that sort of strong bounded community. So in order to advance learning at later stages, it's necessary to find ways of challenging assumptions, introduce new things into the whole learning process. And the best source of new things are other learning communities. People who do things differently, think about things differently, have different types of experiences, different sorts of assumptions, who can act as a form of challenge. But in order to do that, in order to advance learning in this situation, you have to break away from some of the conditions that are necessary at the start in order to initiate learning, to develop new models of learning. And essentially, in this context, it's about building bridges, building connections with other learning communities, and changing the boundaries so that they're no longer strong boundaries that help to define the community, but now become porous boundaries that allow learning and assumptions to break through the otherwise sort of strong divisions which have been created. And so this is one of the things that's coming out very strongly within all this body of work around communities of learning. So that's the second thing. The third thing is Granovetter's notion of the strength of weak ties. And this is arising out of a lot of the work on networks, which social networks, which is becoming sort of very popular now, partly because of the rise of digital technologies and the rise of network systems in a whole variety of ways. But one of the things that Granovetter tapped onto, which is at its heart is a profoundly simple idea, is that whenever we want to try and sort of get new information, then there's little point in talking to the people who we know very, very well, because the chances are most of the people that we know very, very well already know most of the things that we already know. In order to get new information, you need to talk to people that you're loosely connected to, because they have other networks. so that this his point about the strength of weak ties is that the best new information comes from people that we're weakly connected to rather than the people we are strongly connected to. And again, there's a sort of a theme clearly emerging from all three of these notions: open source thinking, trying to create porous boundaries between communities, trying to make use of weak ties, given that they give us access to new information and how important new information is to develop innovation and new ways of doing things. And in my eyes, each of those three different sets of ideas, which are emerging in a number of different contexts, all lead towards the idea in terms of schools, towards the notion of collaboration, and trying to break boundaries between schools and get schools connected as a way of trying to develop innovative models to deal with the sort of problems that we are working with and the sort of challenges that we're facing at the present time. Now, within Northern Ireland, we are fortunate to some extent, and we do have a collaboration agenda that's been around for a number of years and has been advanced in a variety of ways. There have been a number of influences over the last decade or so that have helped to create a context where a collaboration agenda has become more important. Part of it arose out of the post-primary review, where we were struggling with ways of trying to maintain a diversity of school types in terms of the curricular specialism, yet avoid the sort of unfair status differentials that had established between them and all the inequities that had been established between them under the old sort of competitive arrangements. And collaborative networks was one way of trying to address that particular issue. This BEIN strategic review in 2006 pointed to the economic sort of challenges created by a system where we, in some sense, had more schools than we actually needed. And there needed to be some way of trying to provide more effective delivery of education with the sort of available resources that we had. Added to that, one of the consequences of large numbers of relatively small schools was the situation where a relatively arbitrary mix of curriculum was available to young people whenever they were making key decisions at points of their educational career. So in order to try and find ways of providing access for as many young people as possible to a wider range of curriculum as possible, the idea of rationalisation and collaboration were highlighted in the BEIN report as a way of trying to take things forward. One other element of the BEIN report struck a particular chord with me, because one of the things he also argues that those collaborations should be across the denominational sectors, and we could use that mechanism of collaboration as a way of trying to promote reconciliation processes and make the sort of institutional boundaries that we create in denominational terms between our young people more porous in terms of those outcomes. And that links into a third reason around promoting good relations, which is something that we're working on in a sharing education programme, where we're trying to support the development of collaborative networks of schools across the religious divide, specifically to try and improve educational situations, but also to try and establish and support reconciliation processes. But a large part of the collaboration agenda at the moment seems to me to be too narrowly focused on aspects of the revised curriculum and the entitlement framework. And sometimes I think there's still a form of, if you like, linear thinking, that whenever we're trying to address issues around collaboration, we can do it around particular things, but we don't have to do it around lots of things. And you can actually set boundaries around the sort of collaboration which is taking place. There's a doctoral student in the School of Education who did an analysis, an absolutely fascinating analysis of education and library board documents on collaboration, providing advice and guidance to schools and how they should go about it. And one of the things that leapt out enormously from his analysis of the documents was the sort of message to the schools that we want you to collaborate, but don't worry, it's not going to change you very much. You're going to be able to maintain the boundaries of who you are and what you are. And that, to me, is exactly the wrong way to think about collaboration, because if it's going to work, it has to be dynamic, it has to be given a little more freedom, it has to be allowed to reach out into other areas, and that's what we're trying to do within the sort of sharing education programme. So what does that all lead us to around teacher education? And what are the sort of things that potential implications for teacher education? Well, on one level, I mean, if you look at teacher education in Northern Ireland at the moment, because there have been recent evaluations of all the sort of teacher education programmes, and all the evaluations have been very positive, and that doesn't surprise me in the slightest, because the people who work in teacher education across all the different institutions are deeply committed to what they're doing, deeply committed to their students, and deeply committed to providing the highest possible quality of programmes to them. But all of the evaluations are based on criteria of best practice. And all of that is sort of necessarily defined in terms of what was done in the past. And that, to me, is the wrong way of trying to set benchmarks or ideas on what we should be doing, because, as I've already tried to argue, most of the way in which we organise the system is so structurally divided, it leads to huge inequalities anyway. So to talk about the current system as being a system that promotes inclusion seems to me to be a nonsense. And if we continually judge everything in terms of what we used to do, and whether it matches up to what we used to do, then I don't see any way of breaking out of that. What we need to do is to use a different form of benchmarking around the idea of next practice. Recognise that we're dealing with new problems that require innovative solutions, and so we need to try and think up of new ways of trying to address these. And that's where all the stuff around open source thinking about networking and the consequences of networking and a different type of approach to learning communities needs to come in to try and develop new ways in which we want to think about the education system generally, but also about teacher education in particular. And that leads me to the conclusion that if we want to think about priorities for teacher education going into the future, then we need to begin with an idea of whether we're serious about the rhetoric of inclusive schools and inclusive education. I mean, we heard earlier, as I said, examples of schools that are doing amazing things trying to create inclusive processes within their own schools. But that process is always going to be hampered if the system as a whole is dragging everyone in a different direction. So if we're serious about an inclusive education system, or a system in which inclusion is one of the core values and one of the core practices we see that we want to see developed in that, then given the structural divisions that exist within the education system, then we need to try and find ways of connecting schools and getting schools engaging with one another and these type of collaborative open source approaches. And in some ways, it struck me it was entirely appropriate, this type of thinking, for the conference that we're at, the School Dance Conference, because it's about trying to reach out across borders. And if we're going to get schools to do that, then we need to have ways of training principals to lead across borders. We need to have ways of training, of taking teachers to teach across borders, and all the sort of implications that follow from that. And that leads to a situation where we need to entirely reimagine our approach to teacher education so we train young people to teach and to lead across borders. And that, to me, is the starting point.